Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It's February 14th, 2013, and today I am talking to Annie Michon of AnnieMichon.ch, and I'm sure many of you will already be familiar with Ms. Michon and her work. If not, I hope you will go check out her website. Of course, the link will be in the show notes for today's episode. And we have also had one previous conversation a few years ago now on CorbettReport.com, so you can check that out if you really are unfamiliar with Annie and her excellent work. But Annie, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today. I really appreciate it.
Well, my pleasure, James. Thank you for having me on.
Well, Ms. Michon, today I wanted to talk about a very interesting post that you made towards the beginning of the year, as during the Christmas break, the New Year's break, when most people were partying and paying attention to other things, the U.S. Congress was busy, actually the Senate was busy, passing a FISA Amendment Act extension. And this is an extremely interesting little piece of legislation that, unfortunately, sadly, quite an indictment, I think, has received almost no attention whatsoever in the mainstream media, and even the alternative media has largely let this pass under the radar. So perhaps you can tell us a little bit about the FISA Amendment Act and why this extension is important.
Well, this is an interesting one because it extends the powers of the intelligence agencies, all 16 of them in the US, basically allowing the intelligence infrastructure to hoover up information, electronic communications, sent by Americans to anyone abroad. And of course, you know, there have in the past, there were very strict controls saying that organizations such as the CIA could not investigate aggressively American citizens. But this little extension allows them now to eavesdrop and to look at who you're talking to and all that sort of thing. And it's interesting the timing, as you mention, because again, 12 months ago, just after Christmas, I think it was the 31st of December 2011, President Obama indeed signed another act which eroded American citizens' rights within America, which was the NDAA, which allowed him to extrajudicially deal with people who are deemed to be enemies of the state within America, even if they're American citizens. Just as, you know, since 9/11, the U.S. has been extrajudicially dealing with people they deem to be a threat to America outside America. So it's very interesting that they seem to use the holiday period to sneak through all sorts of horrible new laws that erode the basic constitution of America and the rights of everybody around the world, and they expect to get away with it. Sadly, they do.
That is very sad. And of course, in this case, it has to do with the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which was set up as a way of basically rubber stamping warrants for the NSA and agencies to spy on the conversations of people suspected of being involved in terror, etc. But in order to even get around that rubber stamp court, the Bush administration basically signed an executive order trying to get around that, and the FISA Amendment Act was part of that, basically doing an end run around that entire process and putting it into law. And unfortunately, that has been extended with very few senators being even bothering to oppose this legislation. But interestingly enough, you had a post on your website pointing out something, an aspect of this that I hadn't seen covered really on any of the other alternative media websites, and that's it's a post called Echelon Redux, in which you make the point that really FISA amendment and all of this is to a certain extent window dressing to cover up the fact that for all intents and purposes, the intelligence agencies, the alphabet soup agencies, have had the ability to do this type of warrantless wiretapping for a long time through the Echelon network, which still receives very little attention, even though it's been exposed for over two decades now. Perhaps you can tell us a little bit about Echelon, what it is, and how we came to find out about it.
Well, Echelon is a very frightening setup. It was exposed in the 1980s by a very good investigative journalist in the UK called Duncan Campbell, and a very good journalist in New Zealand called Nikki Hagar. And then Duncan revisited it because he had to give evidence to the European Parliament in 1999. But basically what we have here is an old setup where the agencies, the eavesdropping agencies of the US, the UK, Canada, New Zealand, and Australia, so all the English-speaking Anglophone sphere of the world, had an agreement whereby they could legally eavesdrop on people outside their own territories without having to go through the hassle of getting any sort of warrantry, any sort of political oversight or permission to do that. And because of the Echelon agreement, they would then share that information with their partners. So, for example, in the UK, since the 1980s, the intelligence agencies have not been allowed to eavesdrop on UK citizens without getting warrants from the politicians who are notionally their political masters. Even the UK listening post, GCHQ, Government Communications Headquarters, which is like the American NSA, had to get a warrant to do anything which might involve UK citizens. So this echelon agreement allowed, for example, GCHQ to ask the NSA, who could legally eavesdrop on people in the UK without a warrant, to hoover up the information they wanted and then send it through to them. And then just in the same way as reciprocal arrangement, we had the NSA saying to GCHQ, oh, we've got some calls we'd like you to pick up in the UK, in the US, sorry, without any sort of warrantry because you're snooping on a foreign country, and then give us the information. So for decades, we have had a situation where all the eavesdropping spy agencies have been able to share this sort of information within the Anglophone sphere. And it has sidestepped whatever democratic window dressing has been put in place, both in the US with the Constitution and with various intelligence protocols, and also in the UK, where we've had a series of laws, such as the IOCA, Interception of Communications Act 1985, RIPA, which is a Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act 2000, which was supposed to protect the privacy of UK-US citizens. But by having this very close sharing relationship between the NSA and GCHQ, certainly, they've managed to sidestep all these democratic oversight mechanisms anyway. So, as you say, FISA is a sort of window dressing. It's putting on a more formal footing the fact that the government can spy on its citizens. And I think one point perhaps that's interesting is they want it to be known. They want people to know that they can be spied on now because the tech is there, and it's becoming much more endemic. And I think it's a way of sort of censoring the population or making the populations self-censor themselves.
I think you're exactly right on that. And of course, that plays on the idea of the panopticon, which is an idea not only for an actual prison that was developed by Jeremy Bentham back in the 18th century, but also for a psychological phenomenon where prisoners can be made to police themselves if they feel like they're being watched at all times. So what does it say about our society that we've come to the point where this type of thing can be openly admitted and yet not even basically covered or just on a covered on a surface level as a passing mention in the newspapers? Have we arrived at that stage where we have completely internalized this police state?
I think we're certainly getting very close to it. There's a wonderful talk, I would recommend anyone to try and track it down on the internet while it's still free, by a man called Professor Aben Moglen, who is the Columbia law professor, and he's been campaigning on these issues for many years. And he did a wonderful talk at an event called Re Publica in Berlin. It can be found, in fact, on the front page at the moment of my website, saying that free thought demands free media. And what he means by free media is media where we are not policed at all times, where we are not conscious that our communications or what we download, what we ingest, what we read, what we watch, what we listen to is being monitored all the time. And there are still certain ways to get around it. But these new laws coming out and being promulgated by our governments are making us much more afraid. It's a bit like you go back to the 1930s with the Nazi book burnings. These are forbidden books. You're not allowed to read them. They're dangerous. They might corrupt our youth. And now this sort of endemic knowledge that whatever we might download, whatever we might read, whatever we might write can be hoovered up by the spy agencies and used against us as the laws shift and change in the future, does or can lead to self-censorship. And this is a real danger for any notional democracy. So, the idea of the panopticon is frightening. And I think also one other point is, I sort of jokingly said for years now that TV shows like Big Brother, where you're watched 24 hours a day, and if you're lucky, you win and you get a C-list celeb lifestyle or something, or even social media organizations like Facebook are grooming us to the idea that sharing all our information, exposing ourselves out there on the internet, allowing people to watch us all the time, it's a bit like paedophiles grooming child victims. They are normalizing this endemic surveillance culture, and I think it's very dangerous.
That's unfortunately, I think, a very apt analogy, and absolutely a very disturbing overall societal phenomenon. And let's put that in a broader context, because there's not only the drive that's being put on us at a societal level to get us to share our personal information, but then there's also the demonization of sharing of other sorts of information, for example, through peer-to-peer file sharing, and the use of the term piracy and all of that political brouhaha surrounding that. Mm-hmm. And on that note, you had a recent post, The End of Privacy and Freedom of Thought, talking about the fact that Telstra is implementing deep packet inspection technology to throttle peer-to-peer sharing over the internet. That's a lot of tech speak for people. Perhaps you can break down a little bit what that means and why this is an important part of this puzzle.
Well, it's also a lot of tech speak for someone who is trained to be a classicist. So pardon me if I get any of the tech wrong to say that in advance to the techies. But no, my understanding is that peer-to-peer sharing, the whole sort of Tor onion framework where you can tunnel under the internet and maintain your privacy, which is what a lot of hacktivist geek people do already. And this is how big file sharing sites like Mega Upload or the Pirate Bay have managed to keep people relatively and also media, people and media free, is now being threatened. Because as soon as you get into the point where you're looking at the individual packets of information going over the internet, you can see everything. And the trouble is that once, if you use the excuse, for example, that big entertainment companies need this in order to see if their films are being ripped off, they need this tech to get in and actually look at the individual packets of information going. Once that is in place, of course, it'll be used and abused by everybody, down to and including the intelligence agencies, the police infrastructure, the apparatus that is now monitoring us. So as soon as the tool is in place, it will be abused. And the whole idea of copyright, of not pirating films or music or whatever, I see as a sort of stalking horse, a reason why they then get the capability to do this. And, I mean, it's seen very clearly, for example, with the arrest of Kim.com in New Zealand last year. I mean, it was a wrongful arrest. It broke many, many international and national New Zealand laws. And they took down his file-sharing site, Mega Upload, on very spurious grounds. Now, he hadn't broken any laws. What he offered was a service, effectively, where people could park information, a bit like Google Docs. So many, you know, most of the customers using it were legitimate clients, businesses, renting space. They could share documents. They could work on documents. They could share media, whatever, which was theirs. Then, of course, other people did use it as a mechanism of uploading and downloading media, which is copyrighted. And that was the excuse to take down this legitimate site in an illegal way. And we've seen this again also in the UK. Various people like Richard Edouard, who's a student, set up a company called TV Shack, which offered the same services. And it was a sort of signpost, a signpost website that showed you where you could go to download media for free. He hadn't broken any laws. He was not hosting any copyright material in the UK. The UK authorities had no interest in prosecuting him whatsoever, and yet they still threatened him with extradition to the US, where he would face 10 years maximum security prison time for doing something which was perfectly legal in his own country. So we're seeing this sort of mission creep around the issues of copyright and piracy, which then will be abused by this, you know, our national intelligence infrastructures. And I think it's a sort of symptom of corporatization and corporatism, which, of course, is the Mussolini definition of fascism, where the merger of the state and the corporations takes place, and the state becomes subject to the will and whims of the corporations to keep their profits in place.
Well, unfortunately, this is the type of issue it's very easy to identify some of the problems, or easy to identify if not to spread the information about these problems, but it's much more difficult to really suggest solutions, especially when we are in this type of system where the authorities, so-called, self-proclaimed, seem to be hell-bent on breaking, bending, subverting, and basically overturning all laws and precedents that have been designed, at least theoretically, to restrain this type of action. What do you see as anything positive on the horizon, or any people out there that are doing something to make a difference and potentially to overturn this these unfortunate precedents?
Well, there are many, many hacktivists, as they become labeled, people who have a certain degree of tech savvy, who are politically aware as well. And we've seen an explosion of awareness around these issues. I mean, WikiLeaks was one of the organizations that really brought it to the fore. The idea that transparency and accountability will bring about social justice. I mean, what a great way to approach the world, by offering a secure and a very accessible platform for potential whistleblowers to expose criminality on the part of corporations and governments globally. They have done a massive service to potential whistleblowers. But it's the whole ethos as well. I mean, organizations like Anonymous or LulzSec or the hacktivist ethos does give me hope. And I've written many times in the past that I think the geeks will be our last defense against the encroaching fascism of our corporatist Western states now. So there is hope on the horizon. And I have to say, looking at how the hacktivists, the geeks work, they're small groups, they're individuals, up against the huge resources of corporatist states, and yet they still seem to outsmart them at pretty much every turn. So you get this sort of great lumbering, stunned enemy coming after the hacktivists, but they're quick and they're nimble and they're bright and they are motivated. And I really do believe geeks could save our world.
Well, I certainly share your optimism on that point, and I certainly do hope that that there is some possibility for breakthrough there, although I have my own misgivings about the security of platforms like WikiLeaks, etc. But at any rate, there are people out there that are at least attempting to do something about this. And mm-hmm. on that note, you recently attended the SAAII Award ceremony at the Oxford Union Society, where you also gave a speech. Perhaps you can talk a bit about that award ceremony and the types of people you were speaking with.
Well, that was a rather lovely ceremony. It's the Sam Adams Associates for Integrity in Intelligence. So it's a bunch of people who've come out of various intelligence agencies around the world. The CIA, GCHQ, MI5, the FBI, NSA. And many of these people have spoken out. They've become whistleblowers and been persecuted for it. And every year they have an award, which they honor someone they see coming out of the intelligence agencies, or even just doing a job from within the intelligence agencies and doing it well with integrity. And this year it was given to a man called Dr. Tom Finger, who was the coordinator of the 2007 National Intelligence Estimate in the US. And this was the estimate that said, looking at all the information coming out of all 16 of the US intelligence agencies, we all assess that Iran gave up trying to produce a nuclear weaponized capability in 2003. And that assessment has been reinforced and reinvigorated every year. So purely by doing his job with integrity and not bowing to political pressure, not politicizing his intelligence, which is what happened in the run-up to the Iraq War with the Downing Street memo, Dr. Finger, by making this assessment, stopped the rush to war against Iran. So rather than going, helter-skelter into yet more bloodshed and ruinous war in the Middle East, just by doing his job with integrity, he saved millions of lives. And he was honoured for that. It was great. And many other people went to honour him at the Oxford Union Society. Many of them were former winners. I mean, people like Colleen Rowley from the FBI, Ambassador Craig Murray from the UK, Catherine Gunn from GCHQ, had all been awarded in the past decade the same prize. And we went and we spoke. And it was an amazing gathering of international whistleblowers. And yet, none of the mainstream media in the UK covered this, apart from The Guardian, who only focused on the other award winner who spoke that night, who was a man called Julian Assange, who'd won it in 2010. And all they did then was focus on the extradition case in Sweden. No mention of what Dr. Finger had achieved by putting out a good assessment that stopped another rush to another ruinous war. No mention of all the other whistleblowers and what they said and what they'd gone through to say what they said. No, they just had to cheapen the whole event. It was a wonderful example of how the media could be spun. And what made it even more insulting was that the journalist who wrote this piece had herself been threatened with prosecution under the UK's Official Secrets Act 2 years ago, and she'd got off. So she should have known the sort of forces she was talking about and what we were all trying to discuss, and she ignored it. It was disgusting.
Perhaps she knew it a little too well and has learned her lesson in that regard. It is extremely sad to see that, but it is extremely heartening to see, for example, blogs like your own getting recognition these days and getting quite widespread play online in the social media sphere. So tell people a little bit about using our intelligence, annymichon.ch, and what people can find there.
Well, I just suggest go and have a delve. I mean, I cover all sorts of different subjects. I suppose I see my work as covering three areas: the war on terror, the whole issue about the sort of erosion of our civil liberties around that, the war on drugs, because I'm also working as the director of Leap Europe, which is law enforcement against prohibition, where we, people from around the planet who've worked as intelligence officers and police and lawyers and judges and drug czars are saying the war on drugs has failed. And we need a rethink about that legislation as well, because it's used to invade our privacy and to invade other countries too. And the war on the internet, which we've discussed today. So there's a whole sort of mishmash of interconnected, as I see them, issues, which came out of my original years working as an intelligence officer for MI5, and also then helping to blow the whistle and living through the whole media shitstorm and the corrupt judicial process and everything. It was Yeah, it was quite a hectic 15 years. So I cover all sorts of different aspects, try and put as much information as I can out there without ending up in prison or getting extraordinarily rendered. And it's great. It's getting a bit of coverage, as you say now.
Well, it is great to see. And once again, I hope people will check that out. So once again, I know you're a very busy woman. I thank you for your time today. And I wish all the best to you in your work helping to shed a light on these types of issues. So thank you again for your time.
Well, thank you, James, as well, for giving me the airtime.